Hey guys, welcome to the HYM podcast, the podcast talking about all aspects of motorsport, from four wheels to two wheels and everything in between. I'm your host, Nick Yellerly, BMW factory driver, and I'm joined by fellow Brummy and host Jake Hughes, Rocket Venturi Formula E reserve driver, and also producer Alex Murley, ex-World Supersport rider.
So on today's episode, we have somebody I'm really looking forward to speaking to. He started his career in the days of Formula BMW before moving into Formula 3 and eventually into the world of GT racing, where he's been a factory driver for BMW since 2014. So it's here to talk about that, how he got into racing, plans for the future and all of the above. It's Mr. Jens Klingman. How are you doing, sir?
Good. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you and have a little chat.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, mate. I mean, we know each other relatively well as of 2018, I think, the first time we spoke. But let's rewind it back a little bit and yeah, tell us about how you got started with this crazy journey that we're on at the moment.
So yeah, I just turned 30 last year. And I think I started racing, probably like you, when I was quite young. I think my father bought me a go-kart. I remember the day when I was five years old. And I was, now I'm quite tall, as you know, yes. But back then I was quite short and very light and skinny. And I was really afraid of going to the go-kart track. And that was when I was like 5-6 years old. And then our friends, they had a little farm next to Heidelberg, next to Hockenheimring, where I initially come from. And I was so scared of taking it on the racetrack. So I just drove it at the farm, just in circles. And then at some point I felt ready and we went to the go-kart track in Waldorf, where also back then already Sebastian Vettel started his career. Not exactly there, but he was also one of the guys racing there in the Bambini class. And that's where I picked it up, basically. And you know yourself, when you're young, then you just do it as a kind of a hobby and you have a little bit of a passion for it, but you obviously don't know what you get into all of a sudden. And then it just was growing there from there on, to be honest, and cutting a long story short and up to go-karts, Italian Open, which was a good thing back then, and even European Championship. And then I won the German Championship also. And then from 16 onwards, I basically jumped into Formula BMW, where I probably set the basics for being back with them since 2014. Won the first year as a rookie champion and won the championship in the second year. And we had good drivers there, like Marco Wittmann was one of the drivers, Christian Vittorius, who used to to race DTM with Mercedes and some other good guys. And then moving on to Formula 3, where I didn't probably have the best car back then, was also the first year with Volkswagen. And then I also realized that at some point, if you want to earn money with this sport, because then I was about 18, 19 years old, then I moved into GT racing. I was really lucky enough to get invited back then by, first of all, it was BMW Alpina. And they invited me to do a test in Monaco. And I think I did well. I was just driving. I had no idea of how to treat a race car or if the shifting was good or whatever. I had no clue about balance. I just drove and it was good. But then I raced a couple of races with them, but I didn't race the full season in GT Masters. And then, cutting now a longer story really short, I ended up with Audi for some years, GT Masters. And now I'm back with BMW. Since 2014, and hopefully we both will stay there for many more years to come.
Yeah, exactly right, mate. I mean, I'm sure we will do. Being a BMW is a great thing and a great series of
it's the
people.
The best manufacturer.
By miles. So
it's clear.
Jake might have a little objection with that. With his
have to be a bit
Mercedes.
Careful.
But I mean, in general, GT sport, actually, I didn't realize that you had started so young. So for me, I was actually 15 when I started, so quite late. And Jake as well was 15. When did you start racing in bikes, Alex? I actually never asked you.
So I was 2012 was my first season. Yeah, so I was 12, 13 when I started.
12, 13. Okay. So it's amazing different people.
Yeah, relatively. I think, you know, the three of us, we were relatively, in terms later, you two were a bit later than me, but I was still a latecomer to the bike side of it. So,
it's interesting how it all plays out. And then Jens, you say that you actually figured out at a young age of 18, 19, that you wanted to become a professional driver. You wanted to earn some money, which is obviously what everyone wants to do, but be a professional racing driver is the main thing. Why did that decision come about? Was it lack of funds in the Formula cars? Because that's a big big thing, or was it just you preferred the GT side of
That's a very good question. Actually, I think I have never talked about this, to be honest, before. So that's a good point.
Yeah, mate.
Yeah, you raise a really good point. I think, to be very honest, the Formula 3 didn't go so well. And back then it was Hülkenberg, Valtteri Bottas was there, Alex Sims, Charlie Kimball, who races now IndyCar. Probably I forget most of the big names. Eduardo Mortara was there, but really, really good guys. Good it was guys, super yeah. competitive, and you had to be really spot on also in terms of in terms of everything, but also the car and the engine, everything. And then the second year I could have done, because back then I had a manager, but he had a good contact then also to, first of all, to Audi in first place. And when I was at Volkswagen, they also gave me then later a shot with Audi. But it just turned out I had always a favor of touring cars. And even when we went testing with Formula 3, and I even saw the Porsche Cup cars driving with us in a different class, I thought I would at least want to give it a try, because it felt like it's really cool and it looks cool from the outside. And then I never really thought about, okay, how to earn money with it. It was just a natural process of the transition from Formula cars to GT cars and then doing GT Masters. And obviously at the beginning, I didn't earn any money with it. I just tried to make it work somehow. And then the very first money I earned also with Audi when they once invited me to come to Ingolstadt, and they said, okay, we want you to race for us in a Nordschleife with a Quattro car. It was back then a front wheel driven car. It was a TTRS with Tom Cech and Frank Bieler. So also really big names, and then Michael Ammermüller. And then I was already curious when they came up with the budget. And then I said, okay, so regarding the budget, so what's the deal? And then I really said, wow, budget is very difficult. And then they said, yeah, we thought about giving you €2,500 for the VLN race. And I was like, almost
coming my way.
Yeah. I was like, yeah, finally. I was like, okay. sounds good, yeah? Yeah, okay, yeah, well, then let's do it. Then I was really surprised. And then I finally earned the first money. Obviously, then we did 3-4 races. But on that age, I felt like I was a millionaire almost. You know, yeah. I finally could buy my shirts myself and go out for dinner myself. And that was a big step. But it was just a natural transition, to be honest, coming from Formula Racing.
Do you think that was kind of like the turning point? Because obviously, I don't want to say a brave decision, but it's different at the age of 18, sort of 19, to be in Formula 3 and want to look to do something in the world of GT and sports cars and endurance, because, you know, we all kind of get into it with the dream of F1. And then at different points along the way, the guys that don't get there, we find out that that's not going to happen. So do you think that was kind of your turning point when they kind of offered you that?
Yeah, 100%. At the beginning, I didn't feel so... Well, the success doesn't come along very quickly, then you feel like, okay, was this the right choice or not? But in the end, I have to say it was for sure the turning point. And now, as I get a little bit older, doing this for quite some years now, I wouldn't want to do anything other than GT racing anymore. I feel so well where I am, and also what Nick already knows, developing now the M4 GT3 and so many more perspectives you all of a sudden get, like doing some PR for managers, and you know yourself, it's a big field of what you can do other than just going fast for one lap. And that was clearly a turning point. I'm very glad that it turned out that way. But as we all know, in racing, I think sometimes you also have to be really lucky to be at the right spot at the right time. And also when BMW then gave me the first contract at the beginning, it was not like the works contact. They just said, do a race for us. And all of a sudden, one morning I woke up and I had a contract about doing one VLN race in the 24-hour race of Nürburgring. And I said, okay, this can be good finally.
Yeah, it can change, you know, super quickly as well. I mean, from my experience as well, I did my first race with BMW as a one-off. In fact, you were there, I'm pretty sure, 2018 in Silverstone with...
I was there.
Yeah, you were there.
But you did amazing from the first lap already onwards.
Yeah, well, I knew the track well, so, and just, yeah, that helped and everything. But it's amazing that I actually did that quite late on that. Again, 2018, I'd already been racing since 2005, 2006. 2018, I was 26, 27. So it's quite a lot later that I'd moved over from single seaters to the GT side. And Jake actually at the moment is in the process of becoming a professional driver. He gets paid already, but in GTs, most likely, or maybe Formula E. We'll have to see how it all plays out for him. But as I've been speaking to him a lot, and he knows that in the GT world, I've never had so much fun ever. You know, in single seaters, there's so much pressure. You're you're breaking the bank here, there, and everywhere. But it's more the fun and the tracks you get to go to, the endurance side that I've been explaining is super good. So our question for you would be, is the Nordschleife the best track in the world for one? and two, the endurance side of things, is that your favorite or is it still the sprint style?
So as you won it last year, it could have been my favorite track, but as you ended up winning it, it's maybe it's not as good as it could have been, because you know yourself, you love the tracks where you have success, and obviously those are the tracks you like to come back. But it's for sure one of my very favorite tracks. It's, I think, the most challenging track on the planet, I would say. So even the length, and without having any runoff. And when I started racing the Nordschleife, I felt like going 90% or 95%, you end up being super fast. And nowadays, it feels like if you go only 99%, you're really obviously too slow. It's like a qualifying lap every race. So coming back to the question, I would prefer the endurance stuff, to be honest, because I think it's just the next level in terms of you need to share the car with a teammate. So it's a proper teamwork. You need to manage the car. You need to manage the tire. And it's a little bit of a different story than just having a short sprint race. You can play with the strategy. But in the end, like on the Nordschleife, as we know, it is just a sprint race in the end. It's just a sprint race over 24 hours. I think that makes it so special. That's why I would always prefer the Nordschleife. I think this year, hopefully we have another shot, not together as far as we know.
No, maybe not.
Maybe we can turn around this year and make the Nordschleife my number one track then.
yeah, for sure.
You won it last year, mate, so give me a shot now.
Yeah, your turn now.
you can't be too selfish, mate. The only time I've ever raced a car with a roof over my head, and I think it's something I mentioned in a previous episode, it was actually in a BMW. I was part of the BMW junior team in 2014, where it was his first year. And they put us in the 235i. And it's like this, you probably developed it, but it's just like this road car, basically, with the seats stripped out. Still got the DSG gearbox in it, and it's the stick and the center console and stuff. But I remember going on the Nordschleife, and it was a different world to what I'd done at that point. It was just like, you know, one half the track was pure dry on slicks and the other half was wet, like monsoon rain. And it was the first lap I've ever done on it. To be honest, you felt a bit out of your depth to begin with. I don't feel like that's bad in saying that. I think
probably most people now, do. Mate. I wouldn't.
but the thing is, you're in a GT3, and I'm like, when I was in that 2-3, I wasn't even, it's not even a GT4, you know. You see these GT3s coming past you and they look like they're going Formula One car speed.
But let me tell you one thing. On a GT3 car, it's almost easier because it's way faster, but you have so much platform and so much control, and it's more precise that in the M2, or now it's the M2 CS Racing, since this year, there's more roll and it's not as precise, and there's so much movement in the car, which also already scares you, kind of. And with GT3 car, it's just more straightforward, I would say. So I would rather do it in a GT3 car, going faster, but pushing hard, then ending up with a M2 or a slower car, because I think those cars, even not even the BMW, just in general, I think they might end up being more difficult than a GT3 car, to be honest. So actually, you experienced the worst already with a half track, being dry and wet on top.
I'm not sure it can be harder than end of the race on Pirellis in GP3.
GP3? No, I don't know. I don't know. It depends, man, because sometimes also with the GT3 comment, it's you're always doing the overtaking. Whereas if you're like a 235, you're trying to do some overtaking of the small cars and then watch your mirrors at the other cars, the GT3 cars lunging you. And I did, I think my first or second race at the Nordschleife was in a 235. And I remember I had to do, I think it was Joel Eriksson, he couldn't come or didn't come to the race. So I did 4 hours on my own in the 235. And that's the most tired I've ever been, I think, getting out of a car. Mentally, I was just done. And that's where the Nordschleife really gets you more than anything, is the mental concentration when you're in the night, in the rain. Like last year, Jens, I mean, that was horrible a lot of the time with the dark. And
For me, it was actually not so bad.
Did you not do too much in the dark? Or was it? I mean,
no, I did some in the dark.
You did some in the dark, because for me, that was my first time actually in the dark properly at the Nordschleife, and then it rained. The race was, so I was shitting myself, if I'm honest.
Yeah, sure. It's very difficult, especially as you said, in the night, you cannot see where the water is standing, and the amount of water is difficult to judge. And then all the lights, maybe you end up with a GT3 behind you, and all of a sudden you just see see white from the mirrors. And it's that's another aspect why it's so challenging, I think, on a Nordschleife life.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. So if we take it back to how the BMW thing started, you said you did some Formula BMW. So I guess the first contacts and them recognizing you was from there. Then your first GT experience with them was what?
M6. Back then it was the 6 series. It was the B6 GT3 with Alpina back then. And then it was the Z4 GT3 already. Back then,
and how was that?
We drove it for another 3 years. Oh man, that car, you would have loved it. It was from, if you compare with the new car now or even the M6, it was an old car, but it was amazing to drive. It had massive aero, so a little bit like the M6. The power was not extraordinary. That was a little bit of our weak point, but it was so good to drive. Then the M6 was a huge step forward with a proper traction control and better ABS and everything. But the car itself, and especially the engine sound, was amazing, man. It was really good.
It sounds next level. Unfortunately, I haven't driven one yet, but I keep asking if there's any like a classic car, you know, can I just jump in and do some laps? That team that we both know, AAI, have one in Sepang that's ready to go, but we couldn't rent the track when I was out there to let me have a go. So I'm still waiting and nagging for that opportunity to drive one, because they just sound so cool.
Yeah, you have to. For me as a tall driver, it was more difficult to get in because the car was so short and the cockpit was really, really narrow. Let's say even the driver change was quite complicated then, but the car itself was very basic. Talking of 2021 standards now, very basic. But as I said, back then it was a beast and had also good success. It didn't win the 24 Hours of Nürburgring, by the way. Unfortunately, a couple of times we were really close to winning it, but it never happened. But I think we won some other major races. So it was a good car. I really enjoyed it.
Successful enough. Exactly.
Yeah.
But when you also, Nick tells me, the first guy under 8 minutes at the Nordschleife.
That was a lab.
Yeah. Just dropped the mic.
I didn't know back then. That only counts when you do it in the race. And in the qualifying, we ended up with 8-0 or 8-0-1. And then I did the start of the race and I was pushing so much to do a short stint and to have only like not even half a tank, just to be able to break the record. And then they said, yeah, but we also want to win the race, so you have to start with the full tank. And then with the traffic, you know, you have maximum 2 laps, and then you hit the back markers from the other groups, the slower cars. So I knew I had to get it done in lap one or two. And lap one, with a very slow rolling start, you lose like 1 to 2 seconds from the start line already to turn one, because you start so slow. And then I did like really low, like 0.2 or 0.3. So I just missed a couple of tenths. And then I already thought, like, come on, you got to be kidding me. That was so close. And then the second lap, that was the first time I did the Flugplatz flat. Back then it was a little bit more of a crest. And I thought, now I have to get it together. That's the only chance I have. And then onto Döttinger Höhe, we didn't have predicted lap time, but we had a running lap time. So you can already check, like, on the Döttinger Höhe, on the bridge, where you are roughly. And I felt like that was good. I had a good chance. And then I saw, like, two small and really slower cars, the back markers of the other group. And that I'm about to lap them. And that was in the very last corner in the last chicane. And I thought, no way that they're going to destroy my lap. And then you have to judge whether inside or outside. And last corner, I thought, okay, I tried on the outside. And they left the gap open, luckily. And then it was like a 7. To be honest, I don't remember exactly, but it was below 8. It was a 7.59.04 something, I believe.
You should have it tattooed on you.
Yeah, really. I thought about it, to be honest. Yeah.
And obviously, because
like
some
here,
yeah, definitely. Obviously, some people wouldn't even know that includes the GP lap, because everyone associates Nordschleife or Nürburgring times as like, you know, a road car can do it less than 7 minutes, but that's not the full, including the GP loop either.
No, I think it would be like a 6:20 or something, 6:25. It would be on the normal lap. Back then it was super fast. The track is currently changing like every year. So they repaved some parts, there's more grip, it's less bumpy. But back then a 7:59 was really a really, really good time. I think now it still is a good time because the horsepower got reduced and the aero even further. Back then, it's still fast. Let's say it's still fast.
yeah, it's fast. I mean, super fast. But what were the top speeds? Because I only got into my first GT3 race was 2019 BLN3 with Schnitzer and Sheldon. So already the BOP was quite, you know, as in engine power was really quite reduced compared to everything else. Do you know what top speeds you were doing, say, down the Döttinger Höhe back in Z4 days? Or
I think it was roughly the same, to be honest. I think probably the pool was a little bit better, and we ran lower, so the aero was also better. But I think the top speed itself in the very high end probably was quite the same, I would say. I would like to tell you 300, but that would be a lie. So.
Yeah, it would sound really cool as well.
Yeah, the 300 on that lap, but just on that lap.
On that lap. 59 is super fast. But for the listeners that don't or haven't driven around that circuit, I think it's the best place in the world. There's nothing like it, particularly if you can get that clear lap, because there's not many laps that you actually get around there where you don't really overtake anyone or you only overtake one or two cars. It's always the first couple of laps when you're on full tanks, apart from if you do qualifying for the 24 and then you have everything.
Did.
And
you can just you send did it. Last year.
Yeah, that's the first time I've had nothing to overtake. It was weird, actually. I felt really alone on the outlap in particular, where you're trying to find your way and look, because you know you've probably only got one lap to get it bang on. To look exactly where all the wet, dry bits were, if it was like it was last year, and then just send it, and hopefully you stay on the circuit.
I think you send it quite well.
what's your fastest lap around the Nordschleife, Nick?
I've done 7:59 something, a low 7:59, and that was, I think, in one of the qualifying races, the start of last year. And when Martin was chasing me, I can't remember. But I think we did basically the same lap time, and on that lap we got overtaken by an Audi that was flying. On that lap we got overtaken and still did a 7:59. He was flying. It must have gone past me at 10 km/h faster. But at the time in those qualifying races, every manufacturer is told to do what they can. Not all do at the right point, but so then at least it can be even by the 6 hour and the 24, and they can get the BOP and the power somewhat
just right.
My best lap time there isn't quite as quick.
Maybe not in a 235.
I didn't want to ask you, Jake.
I've since been in a road car in a Lotus Elise. I'm not one of those I think you call it tourist and farting or something. When you know it's like a toll road for a few hours or something. And it's some of the stuff you see turn up there.
Also it's crazy. That's the thing about the Nordschleife, isn't it? The whole experience. That's why we were talking about it being the best race in the world. Hopefully we can have fans back this year. Fingers crossed. I don't know what the situation's like in Germany with this COVID, Jens, but with us, we are looking like we are starting to come out the end of it. So they're hopefully thinking, you know, June time, we should be, you know, relatively back to the whatever the new normal is, hopefully exactly the same. So then we can have fans, maybe a few out on an outdoor setting by the time the 24 hour comes.
I hope so. I don't know exactly, obviously, but we just read on the newspaper that they are thinking of how do you call it in English, like going back to the normal life a little bit to change the rules a little bit, that you can be outside. Some stores are reopening already, so I think it's going a good way, and I would also hope that there are some fans back, because mainly on the Nordschleife, the event is just so much better when there are fans, and because they're all over it. And if it will be back to normal, Nick, we have to go for a lap on Wednesday or Thursday, Wednesday, just around the track, even with a bike, and just say hello to the fans, because you will see it's just a massive party, and they have so much fun. They appreciate the drivers coming around, and we should definitely do that.
Yeah, man, we should, because we didn't get to do, I haven't done it yet, because 2019, unfortunately, our car I think most of the cars, unfortunately for BMW, were out by, you know, hour three, hour four. And then last year there were no fans. So as an whole experience, you didn't get, you know, the parade or anything like that. So for sure we need to do that.
Isn't it
Brunchen? Now you're a race winner, so.
Isn't it Brunchen where all the party goes off, basically?
It also, it's pretty much everywhere, I would say. Like a couple of years ago, I took my bike out for not a lap on the track, but around the lap, just to see some campers and even have a beer with some of them. And it was Tuesday afternoon, I remember, and the party was on. I can tell you, that was like a massive party. And I think some of them, they don't even know the outcome of the race because they start partying early in the week. But that's just part of it. And they were so happy. And your driver, and cool, come over. And everybody is like not willing to help, but it's a big community. And they are just enjoying the racetrack and even the race. And I think most of them are around for many, many years. And so us probably winning 2010 already with the M3 GTR, but then GT2. And yeah, it's just a big, big community. And I think that's also what we miss in racing, just the spirit of it. And the people that they're cheering for us and they're clapping and enjoying what we are doing. Because in the end, it's also entertainment, you know.
Yeah. It's all about the fans. And for the Nordschleife, like you say, you have almost different cults. So you'll have like BMW massive fanboys, Mercedes massive fan base, you know, different manufacturers, different classes mm-hmm. that everyone maybe takes allegiance to slightly. So then those fans, if a BMW goes by, all have the flags up and they're waving, and it's really like nothing else I've ever seen in my life, which is super cool. And yeah, I mean, racing wise, like I say, it's one of the best things I've ever done. But going back to your racing career, obviously most of it's been with BMW since you've gone, you know, you've been in GT3s. What has been, obviously you've had a load of highlights, you've had podiums and wins at some huge races, but what has been, say, your favorite season? Was it out in the States? Was it in Asia, in Europe? What do you think? I mean, I think I know what you're going to say, but it'll be good for the listeners to
That you know what I'm going to say. So that my future favorite season will be with you.
Hopefully, one day we'll make it back together.
Yeah,
to look ahead. No, I think a special race, just race that comes to my mind was Petit Le Mans with a Z4 GTE. It was pouring down. I haven't driven the car for, I just drove it in Daytona and Sebring. I haven't driven it for half a year. I have never been to Road Atlanta, and I have never driven the car in the wet without ABS. And I got in the car practice one for like 10, 15 laps. And then I got back in the car for the race for the third stint. Nice. And it was raining and I was so nervous because they were fighting for the championship, for manufacturer's championship, and also for I don't know, it was endurance and even the drivers, I believe. Anyways, they were fighting for championships and I was so nervous. I was really shaking. I was sitting there in the pits and it was raining and the cars were going off. And it was massive aquaplaning. I thought, man, that's going to end in tears. And I was really, and then at some point I had to go in the car, and then it didn't take me a long time. And then I overtook one of the Corvettes who were then already, whatever, like fighting for a podium. And then I overtook the second Corvette. And then I thought, okay, man, this is going well. And then Augusto Farfus was in the lead, then overtook Augusto in the SS on the outside. And then I was like, man, this is going well.
Really well.
I did a double stint. They red flagged it. And then it was Lucas Liu and John Edwards with me in the car. And I said, okay, obviously I need to restart the car because it's red flag. And then nobody wanted to drive again because it was so risky still. And then I said, okay, Jens, you know the track best, so you go out for another stint. And in the end, we finished second behind the Porsche, but they were like 2 seconds faster. We finished second overall, so even in front of all the prototypes back then, the DPIs. And I was so proud of myself because I felt like I overcame those difficult conditions. It cannot get any worse than that, other than the Nordschleife, by the way. And I was, even though we finished only second, but second overall in Petit Le Mans was a very good achievement. And I was so proud of it. And I still have actually this trophy that I still have here. It's still full of champagne and a little bit dirty, but I think it's more authentic than. Yeah.
Was that the Nick Tandy one?
Nick Tandy won it back that year.
Remember it now,
with the Porsches. But that was a hell of a race. And I think I personally like that what Nick already mentioned earlier, what he thinks that I'm going to answer. I like racing in the US because the races are quite intense. It's awesome tracks like Laguna Seca, Daytona as a starter of the year. Then whatever, Petit Le Mans, Watkins Glen, Long Beach, we raced almost in Los Angeles downtown. In Detroit downtown, it was awesome tracks. The community is great, and I just like the spirit of it. And you can always connect with a nice road trip as well, and see a little bit of the US. And I learned a lot there, and I also enjoyed racing there a lot on the track, but also off the track. And I'm not saying that Europe is worse; it's different. But for me, I enjoyed racing in the US probably the most. And also when we won the first race with the M6 there, after being a big part of the development process there. We won in Mosport, the first race, which was the third race of the season, the fourth, doesn't matter. I finished second at Sebring, the first year with the M6. It was a good achievement. And then I was really proud of that as well. And that made it really special from the beginning onwards, basically.
No, sure. I mean, the States thing, I was lucky enough, actually, partly thanks to you introducing me to Will Turner and then you being busy for the race in Sebring last year to go out last minute, having not been to Sebring. So you gave me some tips on how to work with the team and to drive the circuit, of course. But I loved it because for me, it's every time you get, well, not every time, but most times, if the situation allows, you get reset when there's a yellow flag. So you can have a 25 second lead. And then it's all reset. You're all next to each other, as in classes. So you've got your DPIs, your LMP2s, GTLM, and then your GT Pro or GTDs at the moment until next year. And then it's like a race start every, say, hour and a half if there's a caution, which is completely nuts. So you have to be on it all the time. And that's what I didn't appreciate in comparison to Europe, where they say maybe just full course yellow it. And then it's, yeah, you sit there for two or three laps doing 80 Ks an hour, but then you have the same gap as long as you get on it good enough. But the racing in America, having only done one race, is for sure where I'd love to just go and do a full season and just see what it was like.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's a little bit more rough. It's a little bit more basic, I would say. The tracks are more, they have less runoff, which I also like. It's not about saying, it's maybe not as safe as Europe, but it's more challenging. Even racing in the streets like you did in Monaco when you won back then. I mean, it's just a different kind of challenge, a different kind of approach. And no tire heaters, you know, you're going to send it on the outlet. You can play with the strategy because a normal race is 2:40. Then you have several scenarios, as you said, with a full course yellow where it resets because they don't have only a full course yellow. They have the safety car then already.
Yeah.
So because when you say full course yellow, you could also think that's like in GT World Challenge where you only do 80 behind each other, 80, and nobody's closing the gap or opening a gap. And I think it's very challenging. It's very different, but same as you, I completely agree. It's super fun, and hopefully we can also make it back together at some point.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I've never done it, but I kind of always associated racing in the US as kind of like sort of the best racing you might find, be able to find in Europe or elsewhere, but without kind of the politics. I don't know if that's kind of true, but that's how it kind of looks to me from the outside watching them. And I don't know. It just looks like it's, like you say, it's pure racing a bit more.
Yeah, I'd say that you're right in a way, as in it definitely looks like that, but it's mostly because it's so stripped back. So they're not bothered about the garages looking perfect with all the bullshit boards and everything like that. It's just proper racing. They turn up, the cars are ready. You know, you drive to the pit lane. You don't, you know, you have your old pit box stand. I mean, Jens knows more about this, but you actually sit on top next to the engineers during a whole race. Well, I did because I just wanted to see what was going on. It was so fun and there was so much going on. And you've got a special created pit stand where the drivers sit behind the engineers and watch all the screens. And it's just old school, which, like the tracks, the racing's old school, the strategies, it's much more old school. And for me, now I'm 30 as well, liking the old school more and more.
Yeah, and what obviously now with the, I thought IMSA obviously the first ones to do it now. We're changing the GT regs, so that now there's no GTLM, which is GTE in obviously Le Mans and ACO, and they're going to basically a GT3 regulation. So what's kind of your thoughts on that? I mean, it looks good to me.
I think it's good because I think it offers a wider platform for the teams. Because GTE was quite limited to manufacturers as well. And also I think the budget was a big, big deal because you just needed so much money to make it happen. I think we will see probably more teams and better racing because I think GTD is one of the best classes there is, not even IMSA, but also on the planet because first of all, so many different manufacturers and the people from outside, the spectators, the fans, they can still identify themselves with the brand. You know, like our M4 is based on the M4 car, obviously the same with all the other cars. And I think the racing is just more spectacular because it's not like a proper prototype where you lose one little flap and you have to pit and then do an extra pit stop. I think the cars can also hopefully take a little bit of a damage, let's call it, and it's just better for the racing itself. And gentlemen drivers can race it, amateurs can race it, pros going to race it obviously. Then I think it really widens the platform and offers it also to the teams, because even now with DTM switching to GT3 cars, okay, they don't have too many cars yet on the grid, but I think it's just a question of time, and GT Masters is completely full the grid as far as I know. And I think GT3 in general is booming massively. So I think it's, in my opinion, a good step forward, as you can also race the cars all around the globe. You know, maybe they have a Pirelli like GT Masters. I don't even know what DTM is running. Then have a Michelin and the IMSA. But other than changing the tire, you can basically run the car everywhere. And I think that's another point which is really, really good for the teams on top.
Yeah, cost effectiveness just seems to be the main thing. So to get manufacturers like BMW, like Audi, Mercedes to actually want to invest in these big programs, it becomes a lot easier, particularly if they open up, like they did in IMSA with GT Pro, if they open up the WEC side and say cancel GTE, GTLM, GTE, whatever, and just put GT3 cars there, then like you say, you're going to be able to race, hopefully, teams with the M4 GT3 and get a lot of cars out there. and be able to win Le Mans outright, win Daytona outright, all at a relatively cost-effective base as amateurs or pros. So then, yeah, more cars will be sold. The racing will get closer because everyone's getting involved. So I think, like you say, Jens, it could be quite a big step, hopefully coming next year.
Yeah, I hope so. It will be. I'm quite confident. I think it's a good plan.
That's for sure.
It's kind of like what we said in another episode, wasn't it? That, you know, particularly in the context of sort of Le Mans and getting an entry for Le Mans, we'll have so many people that can now take their car to Le Mans, but will need to get an entry for it. That all of a sudden, the other championships will get more cars in the grid as well.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I mean, self-fulfilling, isn't it? The more cars that you have, or more championships that you have running that car, then whoever is rewarded for doing well in those, get developed further forwards and get to do the big races. So it's just going to make competition better in general and just be really quite cool.
I think also, for the fans coming in to learn about GT3 racing as well, it's going to make it like more streamlined as well. So, people watching national championships or stuff out in America or Europe, they'll be able to see that and then go, well, the aim for those guys is Le Mans and stuff like that. So I think it's going to make it really interesting. Really interesting.
I think it should do. So back to the stuff with BMW. Obviously, you are the main guy or one of the main guys with the M6 development, being involved in all that sort of stuff. You do M4 GT4, 235, 23, well, the M2 CS. So you're the development king, particularly on the BMW side. And now with our new baby, the M4 GT3. So talkers, obviously, you can't give us too much detail on the M4. I understand that. But the process or what you really enjoy about developing a car, you can talk about the M6 more so.
No, I understand the point, mate. All good. Yeah. So it's 800 horsepower and only 900 kilograms. That's a fact. So it's going to be great. No, I have the pleasure of really developing most of our race cars other than Formula E and DTM. But I really enjoy that a lot because the example of the M4, when I was in the workshop for the first time, for example, it was just the chassis. And then they came up with a steering wheel. It was out of the 3D printer. And then they said, how does it feel like? Just an example. So you take it and you think, for me, I would like to change this, that, the other. The grip is not so efficient. It doesn't feel right. And then you come back in 2 weeks' time and there are two further development steps done. And then you check out. And then at some point, I think the fourth one, roughly was then the one we went for, and also the button positioning radio should be up here because this is what worked in the M6 and then all that stuff, and then you see it coming together. I think that's already one part which makes it really special. Even the first seats with the M6, they were carved out of wood. We sat in it and we said, okay, this is quite comfortable, but maybe the seat should be higher because, for example, shorter drivers, when they put a cushion or like a kind of a pillow underneath them and they want to sit higher just to have a better view outside the car, the seats should also be higher on the sides, not to make them sit on top of the seat, but really have a good support, a side support. And those little details, they start coming together at some point without driving one single meter on the racetrack yet. But you can see it kind of grow from the get-go. And when you then see it for the first time on the racetrack, once again, makes me also proud being a small part of it. But obviously a driver is also, as we all know, not only a small part of it. You can just give the input and hopefully, it's the right decision also from our side, but it's very good fun just because you see it come together step by step. And also when I said in IMSA, when we won the first race in Mosport, the first year with the M6, that was also, I really cried on the in-lap because it was so emotional after all those tests and then development tests and endurance tests you put in and all those journeys that you have experienced and all the good and bad days. And then all of a sudden you end up winning the first race. That's obviously also something that's really special. And with the M4, in regards to the M4, I'm not saying this because we are here as a works driver, but the car is really good. It has to be, obviously, because the M6 is not the youngest car on the grid anymore, but the car has a lot of new functions which work already really great from the get-go. And I think it's always good if the basic of the car has to be awesome, let's say. If the base is already compromised and then you start building around that compromise, it can only go in a bad way. But the base of the M4 is really, really, really super good, and it worked basically from the beginning. When we went testing now last week, there was no downtime because the car had a technical failure or there was something broken. And I think it's very good that they can really focus on all the test points and really get them done. And we are already at a certain stage where luxury problems are really worth watching into. For example, we have a switch panel like the M6 on the right side, and they have a background light. But when the sun is coming from the back, for some reason, you cannot see the colors of the background from the switch panel. If they like red for whatever ABS off, then it's just white, everything is white. But when I covered the switchboard from the right side with a finger, and it gives a little bit of a shadow, all of a sudden, all the buttons were visible. And then I came to the pizza, said, maybe we can just put a little cover there. And then they made a really good one, actually, out of carbon from the straight away. It took them only a couple of hours. We had a massive, super nice carbon cover there. It looked like it's been there forever from the beginning onwards. But it's nice that we can even take care of those little small things, because as you know, they also count at the end of the day. But if you're only stuck with the big issues for a long time, I think it's still you run out of time to care about the details. And details is obviously the things who make the difference at the end of the day. So I can only tell you good things, but development is also really a part of the job, which I enjoy a lot. And as we all know, I see you very soon also as a part of the development. And then you will see yourself, and hopefully it turns out everything as I said, and you're not completely... don't have another opinion on the things I just said.
I'm sure I'll agree, mate. If you and Augusto have put it together, then I'm sure it'll be fast and all good. So I'm looking forward to that in a couple of weeks. I know from, like you say, from the start of it, you've been involved with that, but also you were involved with the M6. So as a base, obviously, everything develops as the world of motorsport does, but is it the same kind of things that you're looking out for in terms of, like you say, seat fit, button position, stuff like that? Or is it the technology now taking it to the next level where we can, I know we said we've been doing lots of laps, which is great, and we have the luxury of not releasing the car till, is it October time or something like that? So there's still a lot of testing to be able to go on before it goes to the customers, which is great. But is it the same kind of tendencies that you're looking for from the M6 to the M4? Is there a whole different world?
I would say it's quite the same, but it's the same for all the cars. It doesn't matter if it's a GT4 or GT3 or even the M2 CS. First of all, it has to be easy to handle. You have to sit comfortable. Your steering, everything has to be self-explaining, I would say, because some drivers, they don't use it on a regular basis like we do. Even gentleman drivers on the GT3 or GT4, it has to be easy to operate the car, I would say. And I think that's already a good approach, the first approach. And that has been basically the same with the M6. But the M6, we had some issues with the gearbox, for example, and then the cooling was not so efficient, so we had to go up north to Sweden to go testing, just to be able to test, because otherwise the engine would have died. And there were like a lot of things, like big things, that had to be solved before going in detail. And that's why I mentioned it, because now with the M4, you start the car, you go, and it drives. You know, there are no big problems or any problems. And the beginning of the development, I can tell you, was just basically scanning, because you have the car, it gets built on a piece of paper, it gets built with a computer. So you first of all have to check if the real data matches the computer data. So you put like different wing positions, you drive every possible position once, you match it with what you thought it would do, just to make sure that it actually happens what it's supposed to do. And if it's not, then you have to have a look why it doesn't. And that was the first steps, to be honest. It wasn't about driving a particular lap time, it was just about driving the car, driving all kinds of setup, just to do some scans, like roll bar scan from very soft to very hard, and just doing everything once with a lot of system and application stuff in the background. But now that is all done. So now we really go into performance testing already, and also then into endurance running, because as we all know, this car doesn't have only to race for 1 hour in GT Masters, it also has to win the major endurance races, probably starting with Daytona in January 2022. Then it has to last 24 hours at least. So we do already some endurance testing very soon and make sure that it lasts, because the sooner or the earlier we figure out, then we have more time to change, because at some point, middle of the year, you have to do the homologation as well. And then the parts are homologated, so you cannot change too much again. And you can only develop a smaller window. And that's why I think it's already in a good schedule, at least for the moment.
I've got to say, from personal preference, I prefer the look of it compared to the M6, personally.
Say again, sorry?
I've got to say, from a personal point of view, I prefer the visual of the M4 compared to the M6.
Yeah, some people, that's good to hear, because some people, also when I saw the first pictures of the normal 4 Series for the street with this new grille with the kidney, I wasn't so sure, and the people are really hating it on social media. But when you see the car in real life, also the normal 4 Series or M4 or M4 GT3, it looks really cool. And I think even the people who probably they hate it for now, they will get used to it. Even when the Panamera got launched, for example, I thought maybe it's not such a nice car, and now I love it. I think it just takes a little bit of time, but in reality, it looks much better than on the pictures. On top of your opinion already.
I quite like the grill and the road car.
Yeah, I like it. It's good to hear.
I think it looks really aggressive, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It wants to eat you when it comes from behind and watch the mirrors.
Well, wasn't it just going with your world, Alex, with bikes? Wasn't the was it Miguel Oliveira? He won one, didn't he? When he won the first the race in Red Bull Ring.
Yeah,
so he got the first production one.
Oh, yeah.
I remember.
That's not a bad day at the office, is it? You win your first race, and then you get a nice new.
It's better than the kick in the teeth.
That was at the red. That was actually at the launch for the M4 and the GT3. Because I think Philip was there doing some slow demo laps with the launch of that with Dorna and the MotoGP and Marcus Flash. So that was all of that, and then you win.
It was
the
slow
race.
Demo laps, but it was already super fast.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, lap
compared
record,
to DG Masters lap times.
Very confident. Maybe it's because it was Philip driving, not us.
Maybe that's a valid point.
Yeah, exactly.
And how about then?
So, if we talk about some of your highlights from racing, you've, like I said, you've been on the podiums, you've won plenty of races. If you could give me your top three sort of races, I know you've given me one, in order, and why. That would be quite a cool thing for the fans to hear from your perspective.
Yeah. Well, I have to think about it for a second. Yeah, well, I pick two different ones because I could easily say then the second place at Sebring was really nice because it was the second race with the M6 and then the first win, but I already mentioned that, so I have to go for something else. So
let me look at the trophies.
I have one cool one. Because it was in Texas, Austin, we didn't feel like we had a good car for the race. It was my teammate's home race. He lives in Austin. And we started, I think, around P12. So I felt like, it's going to be a long and difficult race. It was super hot. I got into the car, took over, and then all of a sudden, we were leading the race. And the car was really competitive only in the race. But don't ask me why, but it was so fast. And then there was one more pit stop to do. It was freaking hot. And my mechanic, who was supposed to exchange the drink bottle, because we only change it when the driver stays in the car. So my teammate had it all on the first stint. So I didn't have anything to drink on the second stint. And the third stint, I was supposed to get a new drink bottle. And he was so excited of the performance and that we're leading the race that he didn't connect the bottle. He just plugged it, but it wasn't connected. And I was sweating. It was really, really bad and really tough. But when you're in the lead, it's obviously a lot easier to get motivated again. And that was a really spectacular race because it was his home race. And we really, fun fact, had a very nice party because he had a party organized, unless of the outcome of the race, with friends coming over and family. And he had a really, still has a very super nice house there in the area. And it was just nice winning the race from having no expectations when you go into the race, then suffering a little bit, but then kind of also earning the victory and then having a very nice party at his home was really super nice. So it was maybe not the best races in my career, but one I really remember, and was a good time. And what else? Normally, I would say Spa, when we finished second, just around 10 seconds behind the winning sister car, which was Philipp Eng, Christian Kronnes, and Tom Blomgren. Yeah, but then simply was it me in that year, when we finished second.
Yeah,
it was Kronnes and Tom Blomqvist. That was also a good race. But actually, believe it or not, I would say GT Masters race 2 last year at the Red Bull Ring.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that because you know yourself how difficult it is to win GT Masters, especially last year, struggling also there with many things, not only with the car itself, but also from the outside. And then winning at Red Bull Ring also meant a lot to me. That was really one of the highlights because also there, the car seems to be quick at Red Bull Ring. This we knew from the get-go, but when we came there, I said if we had top 8 in one of the races, I would take that immediately. And then had a good qualifying. We both had a good start leading the race 1 and 2, just managing the tire and the race, and then ending up winning was also one of the highlights, I would say. Even though it's only a GT Masters race, but it's been so competitive, GT Masters, in the last years. And then having in mind that this was the only race weekend we were actually super competitive, and then bringing it home with all the pressure because everybody's watching you at Red Bull Ring, and then that was also a really good one.
Yeah.
Thanks for not overtaking me there. So I can talk about this now in a positive way.
Yeah, that was really cool. Your quali lap, I have to say, was mega, because I thought I did a really good lap, and you were, I think it was super close. The top five were 0.045, I think I was off, and I was fourth.
Yeah, I was like 200s or something, like 1.5 hundredths. I was off the pole now. Yeah. 100. It was
exactly,
really close.
Exactly.
I should have gone for a pee, then I could have it.
Just
those couple of grams.
Yeah, exactly.
Or no breakfast.
And then we both went, we'd already spoke about it actually, which is quite funny. We'd spoke about it because we were both starting on the left-hand side of the grid on the outside. And he was like, I'm going to go and try and go outside. And I was like, well, I'm going to follow you. So just make sure you get a good launch. And funnily enough, we both came out the first corner on the outside completely like sideways and crossed up. But the power was pretty good as well. So we managed to get one, a good run, and then the power as well, which is absolutely perfect. So yeah, it was
so good. Yeah, you still owe me the sushi from Saturday, because we had an arrangement that whoever finishes better, if we both finish on the podium, the higher position driver has to buy the other one sushi. He won on Sunday and I finished third, and then I won on Sunday. We won on Sunday, so I bought the sushi on Sunday, but you still owe me the one from Saturday. Just say so now everybody knows.
just leave that one there.
We just do betting on sushi, and that's about it. If we move to this year, I know you can't talk again about too many plans, but you know what?
I don't know, to be honest, too many plans.
Yeah, that's the same for most people. So has COVID, I would say, affected you like it has most people as well, in terms of programs being a bit slower? I know it has from my side. So just talk us about, obviously, your COVID experience. We had, unfortunately, we managed to contract it last year, which wasn't the most fun thing we've ever done. But yeah, after that, we've recovered, and now we're into a new season. Do you think it will get back to normal? And what's your opinion on it?
I would hope so, obviously, as everybody does. But as long as we can go racing in a safe environment, I think we can be really happy with that, because traveling nowadays is not so easy, especially, I think, also from the UK, at least at the moment. So I think as long as we can travel and do races, I would really highly appreciate that and be happy already that just to make it happen, even if there would be no spectators. But no spectators is obviously a lot better than not going racing. I'm going to do VLN, but now it's called the NLS, and 24-hour Nürburgring again, and once again trying to beat you there. Then I'm doing the GT World Challenge endurance races, which I just figured out like an hour ago that it's 5 races this year, because last year it was only 4. Okay, this year it's 5, because they added Barcelona once again, which was on the schedule a couple of years ago already. Yeah. So it's 5 races on that, then development of the GT3, which is a big part of it. And let's see, hopefully GT Masters as well. It's not 100% sure yet, but I think it doesn't get boring.
No, it sounds like it, particularly with the, like you said, with the development of the M4 and it being released to customers, as far as I know, towards the end of the year. I'm sure then we might be flat out through the winter as well, because obviously when, as the listeners may or may not know, once the car is ready, the factory drivers that have helped develop it usually go to those teams. Like you have a lot. I remember
hopefully,
you coming, over here to Donington when a new team bought a car. I think
you, do you remember that?
Yeah, of course I do.
There was a Z4. Yeah, it was what was it called? A 888 back then. They bought
exactly.
A Z4, and I went there for one day to snap up and to show them the car little and give them some advices.
Exactly. Ah, so I didn't know that. Been a long time. Yeah, God. I know when the king is in England. Come on.
Best track in the world.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, cool. Go on. Okay then, mate. Well, thank you very much for coming on. I think we've covered so much stuff there that we can leave it there. So I really appreciate you coming on. I'll do my normal spiel and outro. So thank you very much, mate. Appreciate that. Make sure you follow Jens on all social media and come back here next week for the brand new episode of the HYM podcast. I'll leave Jens's details for his social media below. It's at Jens Klingman with a double N. Make sure also you check out all social media for the HYM podcast. And click, comment, subscribe, and let us know what you think. Speak to you all soon, guys. Cheers.
Cheers, Jens.
Cheers, guys. Yes,
thank you very much.